entirely Protestant, and Mr. Kennedy faced the issues squarely. In his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Making of the President, Theodore White told of what he considered to be the finest TV broadcast he ever heard a political candidate make. According to Mr. White, no transcript or recording of this speech is known to exist. But he recalled that in it, Mr. Kennedy reviewed the historical background of the separation of church and state, and that it included these words.
So when any man stands on the steps of the Capitol and takes the oath of office of president, he is swearing to support the separation of church and state. He puts one hand on the Bible and raises the other hand to God as he takes the oath. And if he breaks his oath, he is not only committing a crime against the Constitution, for which the Congress can impeach him and should impeach him, but he is committing a sin against God. A sin against God. For he has sworn on the Bible.
2 days later, West Virginia gave Mr. Kennedy the clear-cut triumph he had been seeking, and Hubert Humphrey was out of the running. In the months that followed, John Kennedy continued to campaign with unflagging vigor. And finally, at the convention hall in Los Angeles, on the night of July 13th and the early morning of July 14th, he swept aside the remaining candidates in a first ballot victory which followed the casting of this vote.
Wyoming! Mr. Chairman! Mr. Chairman! Wyoming's vote will make a majority for Senator Kennedy. Mr. Chairman, I did not announce the number. We have 15 votes. There are 15 votes from Wyoming for Kennedy.
To make a total of 763, all that was needed. Although the final total went up to 806. A short time later, the triumphant candidate made a brief appearance at Convention Hall.
Governor Collins, Chairman Butler, Governor Brown, and my mother and my sister, under the official procedures of this convention, it is not possible for me to give you an answer to your nomination until Friday night. But I think you can guess what the answer will be.
Was a formal acceptance speech, of course, but before that, a vice presidential candidate was selected, and Mr. Kennedy's choice was the then Senator Lyndon B. Johnson. The first major stage of John F. Kennedy's progress to the presidency was now accomplished. Now began the incredibly demanding ordeal of the final drive, the campaign against Richard Nixon. Day and night, by train and plane, by automobile and on foot, John Kennedy moved back and forth across the nation, calling for the support of his fellow Americans in a drive to new frontiers. Once again, the specter of the religious issue, which he had thought was resolved in the West Virginia primary, raised a threatening head, and once again he faced it openly and eloquently. We have no recording of the speech he made before the Greater Houston Ministerial Association in Texas on September 12th, of 1960, but these are some of the words it contained.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be a Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote, where no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference, and where no man is denied public office merely because his religion differs from the president who might appoint him or the people who might elect him. That is the kind of America in which I believe. And it represents the kind of presidency in which I believe. A great office that must be neither humbled by making it the instrument of any religious group, nor tarnished by arbitrarily withholding its occupancy from the members of any religious group. I believe in a president whose views on religion are his own private affairs, neither imposed upon him by the nation or imposed upon him as a condition to holding that office.
With this definitive statement of his position regarding the separation of church and state out of the way, Mr. Kennedy moved on to other issues, both foreign and domestic, continuing to travel through the country, appearing in person and on television and radio. Finally, in late September and October, he engaged in a precedent-setting series of TV debates with his Republican opponent. These meetings were four in number, and each candidate had the opportunity to set forth his ideas before over 100 million Americans. They covered virtually every topic of importance. And in debate number two, produced by NBC on October 7th, Mr. Kennedy made this point, among others.
There is a very strong moral basis for this concept of equality before the law. Not only equality before the law, but also equality of opportunity. We are in a very difficult time. We need all the talent we can get. We sit on a conspicuous stage. We are a goldfish bowl before the world. We have to practice what we preach. We set a very high standard for ourselves. The communists do not. They set a low standard of materialism. We preach in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution, in the statement of our greatest leaders, we preach very high standards. And if we're not going to be charged before the world with hypocrisy, we have to meet those standards. I believe the President of the United States should indicate that.
Even before becoming president, John F. Kennedy indicated his feelings in the area of civil rights. On the 24th of October, the Reverend Martin Luther King had been convicted and sentenced to 4 months hard labor for his part in a sit-in demonstration in Atlanta, Georgia. When it was brought to Senator Kennedy's attention that there was concern for the Reverend King's safety, he at once called Mrs. King, who at the time was expecting a child, to reassure her. Mrs. King recalled that incident for us.
I remember quite vividly when the call came in, one of his aides said, "Mrs. King, just a minute for Senator Kennedy." And, of course, it was only a brief minute before he came to the phone and he said, "Mrs. King, this is Senator Kennedy. How are you?" And I understand that... He said, first of all, he said, "I am concerned about your husband. I understand that you are expecting a child, and I just wanted you to know that we are very much concerned about his welfare, and if there's anything I can do to help, I'll be glad to do so." And, of course, I thanked him and said that I hoped that he would do anything possible for his release. It was a brief conversation, but he assured me at that time that he was concerned not only about my husband's welfare, but my own welfare.
The publicity which followed this call, as well as a subsequent appeal by the candidate's brother Robert for the release of Reverend King on bail pending appeal, succeeded in their aims and were forerunners of some of the actions which were to be taken in later years. Only a few days were left now in the grueling campaign, and from one of the men who was among John Kennedy's earliest supporters, we received this recollection. He's Senator Abraham Rebikoff of Connecticut, who at the time was governor of the state. And he told us...
There are many incidents that stand out in my mind in my relationship with President Kennedy. But one that is most interesting and maybe significant now was a Saturday before election 1960. We had been campaigning together in New York and Long Island, and were then headed into my own state of Connecticut. It was late, and we landed at the Bridgeport Airport. We started from Bridgeport down through the Naugatuck Valley to Waterbury. The crowds were massive and enthusiastic. And then we got to Waterbury. It was close to 3 o'clock in the morning, and for about 4 hours, some 40,000 people were massed in the Waterbury Green. The president spoke. He was tired. The crowd could not contain their enthusiasm. They kept asking him to come back and speak some more. He then said to me, "Abe, why don't you speak for a while?" And I did. And the crowd still kept on cheering, "More, more, more, Jack." So when he came back, he had this to say. "I will close by telling you of a letter which Lincoln wrote in a campaign very much like this, 100 years ago, when the issues were the same. He wrote to a friend, 'I know there is a God, and I know he hates injustice. I see the storm coming, and I know his hand is in it. But if he has a place and a part for me, I believe that I am ready.' Now, 100 years later, when the issue is still freedom or slavery, we know there is a God, and we know he hates injustice. We see the storm coming, and we know his hand is in it. But if he has a place and a part for me, I believe that we are ready. Thank you." The crowd cheered, lingered on, and about 4 o'clock in the morning, the president to be got a few hours sleep.
3 days later, it was all over. The wearying travel, the endless talking and shaking of hands, the strategy meetings, only too soon to be replaced by the even more endless labors that burden a chief executive. But for the time being, on the afternoon of November 9th, the mood was one of satisfaction, of cheerful anticipation, despite the realistic appraisal of the perils that could befall the nation. John Fitzgerald Kennedy had been elected 35th President of the United States, and he had this to say to his fellow citizens.
May I say, in addition to all citizens of this country, Democrats, Independents, Republicans, regardless of how they may have voted, that it is a satisfying moment to me, and I want to express my appreciation to all of them and to Mr. Nixon personally. I particularly want to thank all those who worked so long and so hard in this campaign on our behalf and who were generous to me in my visits throughout the country and who were generous enough to support me in the election on yesterday. To all Americans, I say that the next 4 years are going to be difficult and challenging years for us all. The election may have been a close one, but I think that there is general agreement by all of our citizens that a supreme national effort will be needed in the years ahead to move this country safely through the 1960s. I ask your help in this effort, and I can assure you that every degree of mind and spirit that I possess will be devoted to the long-range interests of the United States and to the cause of freedom around the world. So now my wife and I prepare for a new administration and for a new baby. Thank you.
The new baby, John Fitzgerald Kennedy Jr., arrived on November 25th, and the happy president-elect turned his full concentration on the affairs of state that were to come under his care less than 2 months later. Inaugural Day, January 20th, 1961, and with it an innovation. For the first time, a poet participated in the ceremonies. Robert Frost, America's most beloved poet, wrote a poem especially for the occasion. A poem prophetically entitled, "The Gift Outright." And shielding his eyes from the glare of the lights, he read them to his president.
The land was ours before we were the land. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts and Virginia, but we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by, possessed by what we now no more possessed. Something we were withholding made us weak until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from our land of living, and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright. The deed of gift was many deeds of war to the land, vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become, has become, and for this occasion, let me change that to what she will become. And this poem, what I was leading up to, was a dedication of the poem to the president-elect.
Then, bareheaded, his hand on a Bible, John F. Kennedy took the oath of office, administered by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren.
You, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear...
I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear...
that you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of your ability...
And will, to the best of my ability...
preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
John Fitzgerald Kennedy was now President of the United States, elected leader of 180 million Americans. And in his inaugural speech, which followed, he rallied his countrymen with a challenge that will long be remembered. You will recognize the stirring words as he uttered them near the end of his speech on that cold January day.
I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you. With a good conscience, our only sure reward, with history the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own.
Ten days later, in the Senate chamber, where he had spent many years as the senator from Massachusetts, President Kennedy restated that challenge before a joint session of the Congress. He first set forth what he considered were the major problems facing the nation and what he hoped could be done to solve them, and then ended with this appeal.
Let it be clear that this administration recognizes the value of dissent and daring, that we greet healthy controversy as the hallmark of healthy change. Let the public service be a proud and lively career. And let every man and woman who works in any area of our national government, in any branch, at any level, be able to say with pride and with honor in future years, I serve the United States government in that hour of our nation's need. For only with complete dedication by us all to the national interest can we bring our country through the troubled years that lie ahead. Our problems are critical. The tide is unfavorable. The news will be worse before it is better. And while hoping and working for the best, we should prepare ourselves now for the worst. We cannot escape our dangers. Neither must we let them drive us into panic or narrow isolation. In many areas of the world where the balance of power already rests with our adversaries, the forces of freedom are sharply divided. It is one of the ironies of our time that the techniques of a harsh and repressive system should be able to instill discipline and ardor in its servants, while the blessings of liberty have too often stood for privilege, materialism, and a life of ease. But I have a different view of liberty. Life in 1961 will not be easy. Wishing it, predicting it, even asking for it will not make it so. There will be further setbacks before the tide is turned, but turn it we must. The hopes of all mankind rest upon us, not simply upon those of us in this chamber, but upon the peasant in Laos, the fisherman in Nigeria, the exile from Cuba, the spirit that moves every man and nation who shares our hope for freedom and the future. And in the final analysis, they rest most of all upon the pride and perseverance of our fellow citizens of the great republic. In the words of a great president, whose birthday we honor today, closing his final State of the Union message 16 years ago, we pray that we may be worthy of the unlimited opportunities that God has given us.
President Kennedy said in his first State of the Union address on January the 30th, 1961, life in 1961, he said, will not be easy. No, life would not be easy. Not too hard, perhaps, for most Americans, but very hard for the millions of peoples living in the underdeveloped countries of the world. The people who knew mostly poverty and disease and hunger. The people who had no freedom except, perhaps, the freedom to die at an early age. No, life for them was not easy. And so help for them was one of the first objectives of President Kennedy and the course he had set toward a new frontier. And so on March 1st, 1961, he announced the establishment of an army of civilian soldiers, the youth of America, who would wage war against illiteracy and the ravages of ignorance and poverty. The youth of America, who would carry the war into dark and distant corners.
I have today signed an executive order providing for the establishment of a Peace Corps on a temporary pilot basis. I'm also sending to Congress a message opposing authorization of a permanent Peace Corps. This corps will be a pool of trained men and women sent overseas by the United States government or through private institutions and organizations to help foreign countries meet their urgent needs for skilled manpower. It is our hope to have between 500 to 1,000 people in the field by the end of this year. We will send Americans abroad who are qualified to do a job. We will send those abroad who are committed to the concept which motivates the Peace Corps.
It will not be easy. None of the men and women will be paid a salary. They will live at the same level as the citizens of the country which they're sent to, doing the same work, eating the same food, speaking the same language. We're going to put particular emphasis on those men and women who have skills in teaching, agriculture, and in health. I'm hopeful that it will be a source of satisfaction to Americans and a contribution to world peace.
Yes, the 35th President of the United States declared war, war against ignorance and poverty and backwardness. And the Peace Corps was his army, our army. But more than just a Peace Corps was needed by our neighbors to the south, the nations of Latin America. And so on March the 13th, 1961, John Fitzgerald Kennedy acted.
Let us once again transform the American continent into a vast crucible of revolutionary ideas and efforts, a tribute to the power of the creative energies of free men and women, an example to all the world that liberty and progress walk hand in hand.
And so the Alliance for Progress was launched on its way to the new frontier, by the new frontier. But how did it fare? Was it on the right course? Listen to what President Kennedy had to say in his second State of the Union message, delivered to the Congress on the 11th of January, 1962.
The Alliance for Progress is being rapidly transformed from proposal to program. Last month in Latin America, I saw for myself the quickening of hope, the revival of confidence, the new trust in our country among workers and farmers, as well as diplomats. We have pledged our help in speeding their economic, educational, and social progress. The Latin American republics have, in turn, pledged a new and strenuous effort of self-help and self-reform.
The Alliance for Progress was on the right course back then in January of 1962. But a year earlier, you'll recall, President Kennedy, in his first State of the Union address, had said that there will be further setbacks before the tide has turned. And the first such setback came in a Cuban harbor that the whole world knows now as the Bay of Pigs. The prestige of the United States was on the rise throughout the free world, on the rise because of such things as the Peace Corps and the Alliance for Progress. But a short month later, in April of 1961, a courageous, ill-advised band of Cuban exiles had attempted to regain their home island from a man named Fidel Castro. They made the try because President Kennedy did not say no. Instead, he took the word of his new and, for him, untested advisors in the Pentagon and in the State Department and in the CIA. But to use the words of NBC's Sander Vanocur in the book Memo to JFK, he had been snowed by the experts. Instead of overthrowing the dictator Castro, 1,113 Cuban freedom fighters were taken prisoners, captives in their homeland. And President Kennedy told the nation,
on that unhappy island, as in so many other arenas of the contest for freedom, the news has grown worse instead of better. I have emphasized before that this was a struggle of Cuban patriots against a Cuban dictator. While we could not be expected to hide our sympathies, we made it repeatedly clear that the armed forces of this country would not intervene in any way. Any unilateral American intervention, in the absence of an external attack upon ourselves or an ally, would have been contrary to our traditions and to our international obligations. But let the record show that our restraint is not inexhaustible. Should it ever appear that the inter-American doctrine of non-interference merely conceals or excuses a policy of non-action, if the nations of this hemisphere should fail to meet their commitments against outside communist penetration, then I want it clearly understood that this government will not hesitate in meeting its primary obligations, which are the security of our nation.
That was in April of 1961. United States prestige could not have been much lower, nor could President Kennedy's. But the times and their pressures could not stand still, nor would they stand still while he licked his wounds. But even if they would, he was not a man to sulk. He was a man of action. He spoke with words that all could understand. His kind of language was the kind that all could and did understand. And so he went to Vienna in June of 1961 to talk to a man who also wanted to talk to him. That man's name? Khrushchev.
I went to Vienna to meet the leader of the Soviet Union, Mr. Khrushchev. For 2 days, we met in sober, intensive conversation. And I believe it is my obligation to the people, to the Congress, and to our allies to report on those conversations candidly and publicly. Mr. Khrushchev and I had a very full and frank exchange of views on the major issues that now divide our two countries. I will tell you now that it was a very sober 2 days. There was no discourtesy, no loss of tempers, no threats or ultimatums by either side. No advantage or concession was either gained or given. No major decision was either planned or taken. No spectacular progress was either achieved or pretended. No new aims were stated in private that have not been stated in public on either side. The gap between us was not, in such a short period, materially reduced. But at least the channels of communication were opened more fully. At least the chances of a dangerous misjudgment on either side should now be less. And at least the man on whose decisions the peace in part depends have agreed to remain in contact. This is important, for neither of us tried to merely please the other, to agree merely to be agreeable, to say what the other wanted to hear. And just as our judicial system relies on witnesses appearing in court and on cross-examination, instead of hearsay testimony or affidavits on paper, so too was this direct give and take of immeasurable value in making clear and precise what we considered to be vital. For the facts of the matter are that the Soviets and ourselves give wholly different meanings to the same words, war, peace, democracy, and popular will.
President Kennedy, you might say, was our conscience. From the day of his inauguration, even before, he had told us how we ought to live, how we ought to be, how we ought to let others live, how, when they asked, how we ought to help others live. But from almost the first day of his administration, there was crisis, one atop the other. And in August of 1961, when John Kennedy had been president only 8 months, the crisis was in Berlin, where the communists built a wall. The president talked about it in January 1962 in his State of the Union message.
The threat to the brave city of Berlin remains. In these last 6 months, the Allies have made it unmistakably clear that our presence in Berlin, our free access thereto, and the freedom of 2 million West Berliners would not be surrendered, either to force or through appeasement. And to maintain those rights and obligations, we are prepared to talk when appropriate and to fight if necessary.
If there was one thing that set a theme, set the theme for President Kennedy and all that he did, that one thing was peace. Peace because he knew the horrors of war, particularly the horror of nuclear war. Have weapons? Yes. but have more than that, too. Far more. A forum where men could speak, man to man, people to people, nation to nation.
Arms alone are not enough to keep the peace. It must be kept by men. Our instrument and our hope is the United Nations. And I see little merit in the impatience of those who would abandon this imperfect world instrument because they dislike our imperfect world. For the troubles of a world organization merely reflect the troubles of the world itself. And if the organization is weakened, these troubles can only increase. We may not always agree with every detailed action taken by every officer of the United Nations or with every voting majority, but as an institution, it should have in the future, as it has had in the past since its inception, no stronger or more faithful member than the United States of America.
President Kennedy was a man who wanted peace, but he was a man who would not run from a fight. He was not a man who would look for a fight, but he was a man who could thrive, a man who could blossom on strife. Hear him again in his 1962 State of the Union address.
A year ago, in assuming the task of the presidency, I said that few generations in all history had been granted the role of being the great defender of freedom in its hour of maximum danger. This is our good fortune, and I welcome it now, as I did a year ago. For it is the fate of this generation, of you in the Congress, and of me as president, to live with a struggle we did not start, in a world we did not make. But the pressures of life are not always distributed by choice. And while no nation has ever faced such a challenge, no nation has ever been so ready to seize the burden and the glory of freedom. And in this high endeavor, may God watch over the United States of America. Some may choose forms and ways that we would not choose for ourselves, but it is not for us that they are choosing. We can welcome diversity the communists cannot, for we offer a world of choice, and they offer a world of coercion. And the way of the past shows clearly that freedom, not coercion, is the wave of the future.
There was another struggle that President Kennedy welcomed, the struggle for supremacy in outer space, a far horizon, a wide horizon for the new frontier. First stop, Cape Canaveral, next stop, the moon, and an astronaut named Glenn is the first American ever to blast into orbit. The date, February 20th, 1962. Listen.
This is Mercury Control. The MA-6 launch countdown is T-minus 30 and counting. T-minus 30 seconds and counting.
This is the last human control. At any moment, the Verniers should light. General Dynamics Tom O'Malley starts the stamping motor.
The Mercury spacecraft umbilical is out. We're at T-minus 19 seconds.
The firing button.
T-minus 10 seconds and counting. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2,
there
1,
the ignition of the Verniers.
0, ignition, liftoff. The MA-6 vehicle has lifted off. Trajectory looks good.
Thank you.
The spaceship Friendship 7 cut the Earth down to size, and the telephone spans sea as well as land, from White House to a man just returned from the wild blue yonder.
Hello?
Hello, sir?
Colonel?
This is Colonel Glenn.
Oh, listen, Colonel, we're really proud of you, and I must say you did a wonderful job.
Thanks, Mr. President.
Well, we're glad you get down in very good shape. I was just watching your father and mother on television, and they seemed very happy.
Well, it was a wonderful trip. It's almost unbelievable to think back on it right now, but it was really tremendous.
Well, we're going to we'll see you over at I'm going to come down to Canaveral on Friday, and then hope you come up to Washington on Monday or Tuesday, and I'll look forward to seeing you there.
Well, fine. I'll certainly look forward to it.
President Kennedy talking to Colonel Glenn. And now the president talks to the nation about another ocean.
I know that I expressed the great happiness and thanksgiving of all of us that Colonel Glenn has completed his trip. And I know that this is particularly felt by Mrs. Glenn and his two children. A few days ago, Colonel Glenn came to the White House and visited me. And he was, as are the other astronauts, the kind of American of whom we are most proud. Some years ago, as a Marine pilot, he raced the sun across this country and lost. And today, he won. I also want to say a word for all those who participated with Colonel Glenn at Canaveral. They faced many disappointments and delays. The burdens upon them were great, but they kept their heads and they made a judgment, and I think their judgment's been vindicated. We have a long way to go in the space race. We started late, but this is the new ocean, and I believe the United States must sail on it and be in a position second to none.
It was a welcome change for President Kennedy, talking not about another crisis, talking not about the risk we must face in the age of the bomb. It was a welcome change to talk to astronauts and to the nation and the world about our country's accomplishments in outer space. But in less than 2 months, on April 11, 1962, there was another crisis. This one, though, on the home front, and its name was steel. The issue, an unexpected price rise. The action... Listen.
The simultaneous and identical action of United States Steel and other leading steel corporations increasing steel prices by some $6 a ton constitute a wholly unjustifiable and irresponsible defiance of the public interest. The Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are examining the significance of this action in a free, competitive economy. The Department of Defense and other agencies are reviewing its impact on their policies of procurement. And I am informed that steps are underway by those members of the Congress who plan appropriate inquiries into how these price decisions are so quickly made and reached, and what legislative safeguards may be needed to protect the public interest. Price and wage decisions in this country, except for a very limited restriction in the case of monopoly and national emergency strikes, are and ought to be freely and privately made. But the American people have a right to expect, in return for that freedom, a higher sense of business responsibility for the welfare of their country than has been shown in the last 2 days. Some time ago, I asked each American to consider what he would do for his country, and I asked the steel company. In the last 24 hours, we had their answer.
That's what President Kennedy said, and this is what Roger M. Blau, the president of U.S. Steel, answered on the very next day.
When the president of the United States speaks, as he did yesterday, regarding our corporation and its cost-price problems. I'm sure a response is indicated and desirable. Let me say respectfully that we have no wish to add to acrimony or to misunderstanding. We do not question the sincerity of anyone who disagrees with the action we have taken. Neither do we believe that anyone can properly assume that we are less deeply concerned with the welfare, the strength, and the vitality of this nation than are those who have criticized our action. As employees and stockholders, we, along with thousands of other employees and stockholders, both union and non-union, must discharge faithfully our responsibilities to United States Steel. But as citizens, we must also discharge fully our responsibilities to the nation. The action we have taken is designed to meet both those responsibilities.